don't know. He's in the building.
You guys are kind of
good morning, colleagues. Thank you for joining us.
Not our side.
I want, do I have to hit the gavel to call it to order? I would like to call to order the Subcommittee on Education of the Joint Ways and Means Committee for Tuesday, February 7th. Thank you all for being here, and thank you to our audience here and worldwide, as I like to say. This morning, we will be having a public hearing and public testimony on House Bill 5030, which is the Board of Pharmacy. And I am staffed today by Kim Toe from the Legislative Fiscal Office, who will start us off.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. Today, we have the Board of Pharmacy here to tell you about their agency and budget. And Mark Watt is the Executive Director, and he'll be coming up to talk to you.
Marcus, go ahead, bring it in. And then do we call up, does Anthony Medina come up with or after? Okay, great. Joined by Anthony Medina from DAS. Good morning.
Well, good morning. Thank you very much for allowing us to share time with you today, Co-Chairs Smith-Warner, and Monroe. My name is Marcus Watt. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. For the record, Board of Pharmacy is an other funds agency. We do not receive any monies from the general fund or lottery. We subsist completely on our license fees from our licensees. Worked earlier. There we go. Okay. Purpose of the Board of Pharmacy is to regulate the practice of pharmacy and the quality and safe distribution of drugs within the state. We do this, accomplish this through the regulation not only of the practice of pharmacy through the pharmacists and the technicians, but the regulation of all commerce of drugs within and into the state. We are uniquely different from almost every other healthcare board in that we regulate the profession and the individuals, but we also regulate places. ORS 689 grants us the authority to regulate all commerce of drugs in the state. So as a result, we have people licenses, which is typical to most healthcare licensing boards. We also have what I call place licenses. So we license manufacturers, wholesalers, pharmacies, hospitals. This concept is sort of like a cradle to grave type of thing. If you have a manufacturer in New Jersey who's manufacturing a drug that's being sold in Oregon, they are required to license with us and follow our regulations. If there's a wholesaler that resides in Arizona or Texas and they are shipping medications to a pharmacy in the state, they are required to license with us, as are any pharmacies outside the state that are selling drugs to citizens of Oregon. So as you can see, we have an extremely broad regulatory reach. It extends not only to our own regulatory authority, but we are also charged with enforcing DEA and FDA, some federal regulations as well.
Pardon me. Senator Thompson?
Yes. Question. Do all states do that? So if you manufacture a pill or something somewhere in New Jersey, they have you register with every state?
Yes, many of the categories. Some do not. Some states do not require that the pharmacy shipping medications in or mailing them into the state register with the state. However, the majority of them do. But if you're a manufacturer and you want to sell your drugs into all 50 states, you pretty much have to register and comply with the rules of each state.
Follow-up?
Medical marijuana?
That is not under our authority. And we are thankful for that.
Would you like that?
Oh, we've seen a lot of heads saying no back
there. Yeah, there's a major issue there with the DEA. DEA federally considers that a controlled substance Schedule 1. That would conflict with our people whose license and ability to practice is dependent upon being compliant with the federal laws. So separation of marijuana from healthcare or DEA registrants is very important.
Sounds like you practiced that answer.
No, but I've been asked it before.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Board makeup. Our board currently consists of 9 members. We have 5 pharmacists, 2 pharmacy techs, and 2 public members. And this is a change from 2 years ago when I was here. In 2015, the legislature passed a bill that added 2 pharmacy technicians to the board. They've been with us for just barely a year right now, and it's been a very positive experience for us. The their perspective and the things that they bring to the discussions have been very, very positive. We're happy to have them. Board staff members, we currently have 20 full-time employees, and they're loosely based into three departments. Our compliance department, consisting of 8 members, our licensing department, which is with 6 members, and our operations and administration with 6 members. I want to go over just some of the activities that we perform on an annual basis. As I mentioned, the compliance department has 8 members. 5 of those are inspectors / investigators. One of our KPMs is that we will inspect every single pharmacy in the state on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. Even if this were not a KPM, we would do this. This has tremendous positive upside in protecting the public. So in 2016, our inspectors inspected 896 pharmacies in the state. These inspections can be very simple. They can consist of maybe perhaps a 45-minute to an hour visit on a very simple inspection. But in a really more complex or problematic inspection, it can take several inspectors up several days to go through this process. We also conduct investigations. We initiated and adjudicated 565 cases in 2016, which is down from the number in 2015. It was interesting to me to note that 42% of these cases are generated from outside complaints from consumers or other healthcare practitioners, but the rest are all initiated from other factors. We have licensee applications or applicants for licensees that misrepresent their background or their criminal history. We discover things on inspections that turn into investigations. Again, this is another unique aspect of us from other boards in that we actually go out and find things and during our inspections that generate cases. Hearings. In 2016, we had 78 licensees request hearings. And hearings are an extremely important part of our our legal process. They are also extremely expensive and time-consuming, not only for the board, but for the licensees. As a result, my compliance director spends a significant amount of her time attempting to find resolution that meets the standard of the board for protecting the public while still allowing the licensee some satisfaction and flexibility in that punishment. As a result, we only had to go to an actual hearing once in 2016, saving the state and the licensees a significant amount of time and trouble.
Sorry. Representative Wisnett first.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Watt, am I correct in assuming you do not inspect pharmacies in DOC or Oregon Youth Authority facilities? You have no
interest. I honestly do not know the answer to that. We do inspect correctional facilities. I can't speak to the Youth Authority question. I do believe that we inspect the corrections facilities.
Follow up, Madam Chair. And how frequent is that?
That's on an annual basis as well.
Follow up, please. Any problems you've observed or reported?
I'm not aware of any cases that have been generated out of those. We have had some situations where we've attempted to help them accommodate their clientele, I suppose, that have substance abuse issues that are pregnant. There are some issues with writing for Suboxone and opioid maintenance therapy they're pregnant, that we've had to help them get around the DEA, but that's the only issue that I'm really aware of.
Sorry, one quick follow-up, too. So did you advise the correction facility when we had this cure for, what did we have the cure for?
Hepatitis C.
It was very expensive. Did you, because I understand that it was on the public safety last session, and we had this cure for but it was like $80,000, and there were some procedures you could do before you got to go to that $80,000.
We were not involved in that at all.
Thank you very much.
I am familiar with that therapy. It is extremely expensive and of concern to budgets.
It was resulted in an extra budget item, I think, to take care of that. So
and could you follow up with the committee on specifically your oversight for Corrections Department as well as OIA facilities? Could you follow up with the committee and just get back to us?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Thank you. And then Representative Lively?
Madam Co-Chair, so I assume on the inspection side that it's fairly scripted from the standpoint one of the things I assume has a lot to do with records and records keeping in that, but that it's pretty described how a pharmacy is supposed to run, what records are supposed to keep in that. So the inspection is going through a checklist or something that says if they meet all of these things, everything's okay.
That's true. And we have a unique perspective. It's been, I think, 10 or 15 years since we initiated this process, but we were the first state to do this. Every year in December, we issue a self-inspection report. This is, depending on your practice setting, you'll have an individual report. Some of them are up to 9 pages long. But the entire month of January, the pharmacies have the ability to go through and review this. They know exactly what we're going to be looking for. It references the statute or the rules that are effective, and it allows them to go through and make sure that they're compliant. And we have a philosophy of compliance through education. So if it's a minor, if it's not a major issue, they go through and they find out that they're not compliant, and they then correct it. When our inspectors come in and they see, like, oh my gosh, they were out of compliance, they realize that they fixed it, there are absolutely no sanctions attached to that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. In licensing, we have 33 different license types. As of February 1st, we had 27,718 individual licenses. This represents a 9.8% increase over last biennium. I break the license types into two very simple groups for me. One is the people licenses, which are the pharmacists, technicians, interns, and a few others. The other are the place licenses. The people licenses, which are represented on this slide, represent 58% of our total licensees. As you can see, the trend on these licenses is upward. It is also interesting to note that 56% of the pharmacist licensees do not reside in the state. They're involved in either activity of shipping drugs into the state or some activity in the state that requires them to be, or many of them will have gained an Oregon license and they've moved elsewhere and they just want to maintain that license because it's much easier to maintain it than it is to recapture it later.
Mark?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Mr. Swift, sorry. And that, you said it was it says it's an increase of 9.8%. Is that, how long are the licenses? How long are they good for?
Our pharmacists and pharmacy technicians, we just advanced from annual licenses to biennial 2 years ago. All the other licenses are annual licenses.
Thank you.
Okay, the other group that I talked about are the place licenses. These consist, as far as the categories go, these are the majority of them. The numbers in them are not nearly as significant. So I have put up the top, this is not working. Okay, I'm sorry. I have put up the top four categories in the drug outlet categories. As you can see, the trends here are not the same as they are with people. They tend to be negative or neutral. There's some valid reasons for that. As far as pharmacies go, there's some industry consolidation that's happening. I think if you recall, Safeway and Albertsons merged, closed a number of stores. Hagen's acquired some and then went out. So that is the primary reason for the pharmacy numbers. Wholesalers have decreased as a result of an FDA action and classification. Many of them have moved to manufacturing or what we call a DDA.
Yes. Go ahead, Senator.
Question. So those number of licenses plus the licenses of the people before don't add up to the total number of licenses?
No, those represent 78% of our total licenses. I just did not want to bore you with another 24 license types with fairly small numbers.
Okay. It just wasn't making sense to me when I looked at the numbers, so I was thinking, who am I not getting? So there is another group of people who have licenses out there, or another group of
categories.
Yeah,
categories.
We have 33 total. This represents 7, so we have a significant number of licenses.
Thank you. That makes me feel better. Okay.
Go ahead. Okay. Thank you.
administrative activities. You're all aware of the tremendous amount of energy it takes to craft and pass rules. In 2016, we adopted, amended, or repealed 59 rules. It resulted in 40 new rules. This is a pretty significant activity, but we'd had a number of rules that we needed to address that had been sitting dormant for a period of time, so we aggressively went after those. And then we had some significant changes that came about because of legislative action that caused us to spend time with that. Outreach efforts. This is a really distinctive difference between us and most pharmacy boards. I call it compliance through education. We have a long history of wanting to spend time educating people so that we don't have to go through the disciplinary process. We'd much rather spend 6 to 8 hours training a group of people so that they're compliant, so that we don't have to go through that process. Last year we had 28 presentations to our licensees. These range from our monthly, what we call a PIC training class. This is a 4-hour class that we do monthly in our offices. Any pharmacist or technician that wants to come in and learn how to properly operate a pharmacy, know what the hot issues are, and how to be compliant with those, can come to this meeting and walk away with a much higher level of understanding and ability to stay compliant and out of trouble.
Bless you.
The other programs that we have enroll in are outreach and continuing education. We're available to pretty much any group that would like to have a presentation, as long as we can make sure that we have enough people in seats to be able to justify the time spent. We will find a way to make that happen. I anticipate that the presentations will be significantly higher next year. The naloxone prescribing of pharmacists has driven up kind of a roadshow that we're gearing up to do here in the next month or two.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So question on legislation like that. So we passed something saying you can prescribe or dispense, or are you tracking like how many pharmacies, because those are may not shall type language.
Yes.
May do this, not you don't have to. Specifically, what was interesting to me after we passed the dispensing bill for birth control, mm-hmm. in 4 years, there's no age restriction on that. And pharmacies are telling me that even though they can, they are not really interested in dispensing the pill to 12-year-olds yeah. at the grocery store. So do you track sort of who's participating in dispensing once those laws go into effect?
Yes. If we made a mistake in our development of that program and then naloxone, it was not building in some sort of reporting capability. Right now we're having to query the people that we know are participating to get a sense of what that is, but we don't have a mandatory reporting requirement. And we've talked about finding a way to address that going forward. We haven't yet taken action on that.
Go ahead.
We also participate in outreach efforts through the Pharmacy Coalition, a retail and hospital roundtable that we conduct, and the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and Oregon State Health Care Pharmacists Associations as well. I wanted to put up other accomplishments that we've managed to complete over the years. As you can see here, the first one I have up is the Prescriptive Authority for Contraceptives, and thank you very much for passing that bill. I think that allowing pharmacists to appropriately prescribe prescriptions is obviously having an impact on accessibility of care. And while we're just gearing up, I think we're still extremely successful. The bill that you passed and the rules and training program that we developed around it are being used as models in a number of other states. We get calls wanting to know how to do this, how it happened, and everyone is looking to Oregon for insight into how to make this happen in their states. You were the second state in the country to pass this legislation. We were the first state to implement it. California passed the bill two and a half years before we passed ours, yet we implemented it about 5 months prior to. I'm very proud to say that from the date that the governor signed that bill till our staff, working collaboratively with the medical community, the nursing community, the educational community, in 94 days we delivered a product to our board for approval that oversaw the creation of a training program that allows pharmacists to understand how to, as well as all the protocols and everything else that allow them to appropriately prescribe these medications. There was no training program, and this was not being taught in the pharmacy schools. We have a very excellent program now, and it's become successful. I understand that there are 1,100 pharmacists have completed the training and are certified at this point in time. And the best estimate we can get as the number of prescriptions written in 2016 is between 3,500 and 4,000 prescriptions. Now, I totally expect that to go up significantly in the next year or two because of reimbursement issues. This bill plays pharmacists in the position of having to be, I lost my thought process here, but pharmacists need to be credentialed in order to bill for the ability to write the prescription. State Medicaid people have accepted that concept, and they've been working to help pharmacists get that. We have a number of retailers are just now gearing up to be able to bill. When that happens, we expect to see a significant increase, simply because the patient won't have to pay for it out of pocket anyway for the visit itself, and then the prescription will be a separate entity that will be paid for through the PBM process. Another accomplishment was in 2016, you passed a bill allowing pharmacists to prescribe naloxone. This is, again, a very significant bill. Having trained people with access to this medication in the community is critical right now with the opioid epidemic we have going on. The CCOs and medical community in Southern Oregon are especially focused upon this. The board saw how important this was, took steps to move it to the front of their list. In August, they passed a temporary rule that authorized this. So we now have pharmacists that are able to prescribe. Because of the rapidity of which we passed the rules, many of them are not familiar with the process, and we're going through an educational effort right now to help them understand how to appropriately do this.
Representative Parrish.
A couple questions on that particular bill, because that one was definitely a near and dear to my heart. What is the, just ballpark, the cost of that drug? So, because the way the bill's written is any one of us who go in and get that training can go and get that, but, is that something insurance covers? Am I paying cash out of pocket for that drug? What does that look like?
That's still evolving. The current cost, if you were to walk in and pay cash for one dose, is, I believe, as low as $50, but as high as $3,000 if you get the little talking electronic device that tells you how to do that. I'm sorry, I lost the second half of your question.
How much does it cost, and how hard is it to get? That was the first piece. Okay. The second part of my question is, I feel like we maybe missed the boat in roping school districts into that kind of that equation of how do we do that outreach piece. We talked about emergency, a homeless shelter type providers, but I've got kids in my school districts who are using heroin. And the fact is that we have the opportunity to, potentially save a child's life in a school scenario if we can help school districts and school nurses and, school counselors understand that this is something that really they should all have on their campus.
Right.
For that type of outcome. I mean, we get our police text to tip lines, Sally's using drugs in the bathroom. I mean, those are real things that my local police department in my very affluent neighborhoods are, those are the texts that our police are getting. So I feel like there's an opportunity to somehow pair the pharmacy board with ODE and say, how do we help you get this into your school so that somebody in each high school has a dose of this somewhere on campus?
I think you hit the nail on the head with the cost issue. That really is the issue at this point in time. Anyone right now can walk up to a pharmacist, go through a written training document that OHA has provided us with, have a short conversation with a pharmacist, and walk out the door with the product. However, they have to pay for it. The CCOs and the PBMs are a little nervous about this, as if I'm a parent of a child who's using and I want this, is the prescription for me, or is it for my child? If I have a a family member that isn't covered, how do they pay for that? Mm-hmm. Those are all things that everyone's struggling with and attempting to calculate. I do know that the CCOs in Southern Oregon are very much taking a we'll pay for it if it's needed approach to it. I haven't seen the outcome of that, but
I feel like that's something that we need to define, and probably this session somewhere in a, as it relates to pharmacy type bill, or as it relates to insurance or whatever, but just find the right relating to clause to actually address that issue, because some of the, you know, kind of anti-drug groups in my community are thrilled about this, but they're also sort of from the practical implication of who gets access, how do you pay for that access, how do you increase access, particularly, you know, on school campuses. You know, does a mom who just wants the school to have it go buy it out of their own pocket and leave it there with the counselor and say, please keep this, you know, somewhere where it's available? I just feel like this could be so much more impactful if we can put some other, you know, language around it to solve those problems. The last sort of piece I'll ask you is, we've, you know, so we've done this with contraceptives, and then we've done it with naloxone. You know, one of the things on, for me, on healthcare access is how do we get people really practicing at the top of their scope of their license? And I've begged for a subcommittee on scope for, you know, just to just hash that out across the entire healthcare spectrum and not just do these as one-off bills. We haven't got that yet in 6 years. But what other prescriptions are out there that we can help the pharmacy industry with, the pharmacists in our state, so that you really are at the top of your scope of license? I mean, we're doing, you know, flu shots and we're doing vaccines, but, you know, what are we missing?
Yeah. There is a bill that the State Pharmacy Association Coalition is promulgating this session. I believe it's House Bill 2397 that attempts to address that. Right now, you're absolutely right. If you identify a situation that you think access and is can be impacted by a pharmacist prescribing and they're qualified to do so, it has to come to you to approve that individual one, which is a long, drawn-out process. Their bill is attempting to craft a methodology and a process to where an advisory group to the Board of Pharmacy composed of medical professionals could decide what is appropriate for a pharmacist to prescribe and under what conditions, and then direct the Board of Pharmacy to write rules around that. Mm-hmm. This would be much faster, you know, process, wouldn't, you know, so I believe that the State Pharmacy Association has this out there at this point in time.
Thank you. Sounds like someone should have a meeting with Representative Parrish.
I will pass that along if you would like me to.
No, my way. Okay. You know, this is, I mean, people, we can talk about having health insurance and getting people insured. The reality is we don't have access because we don't have enough providers. And, you know, and pharmacists are right there on the front line of being a provider. And so where we can get you safely, you know, working at the top of the scope of your license, I think that is a really important conversation.
Yeah, and that's a great point, too. The pharmacists now that are graduating, when I graduated, it's a bachelor's degree. Right now, it's a doctoral degree, and a significant number of the people that are graduating are doing postdoctoral graduate residencies and fellowships, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So.
Anybody else? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Third item I have up here is the transition of biennial licensure. As I mentioned a little bit earlier ago, we have two license types, the pharmacists and the pharmacy technicians, that we transition from annual to biennial licensure. There were two reasons for this. When I came on board the agency 3 years ago, I was looking for efficiencies and economies in the agency. And it was very apparent to me that if we took our two largest license types and transitioned them from 1 year to 2 year licenses with alternating expiration dates, we could cut out a significant amount of processing time within the agency. We've completed this transition. We've seen a 27% reduction in processing energies. We've seen an improved service level, improved customer service, and we're being able to use that time to be more proactive in looking for other things in the agency. In addition, it's reduced costs, not just related to the processing of the licenses, but just things like mailing costs. It was costing us over $8,000 a year just to mail the reminders for license renewals that we've been able to take out of our budget. The second thing that the biennial licensure has allowed us to do is to work very hard to reduce our ending balance. This has been a problem for the board for a number of years. We've tried very, very hard to drive that ending balance down unsuccessfully. But when we transitioned to biennial licensure, we left the license fees for these two types at the same rate they were. So in effect, the pharmacists and the technicians were getting a two-year license for the price of what they've been paying for a one-year license. This has allowed us to organically drive that ending balance down to the area at the end of this biennium. We should have it exactly where you want it to be, a much lower rate. And then...
Co-chair. Representative Hernandez.
Quick question. One of your key performance measures is continuing the percent audited of pharmacists who have completed their continuing education. What was that number in 2016, and then what was the completed number
okay.
or percentage of it?
Okay. You've hit on an item I'm going to touch on in a minute, but I will
okay.
answer your question.
Okay, I'll wait.
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
If it's going to come up in your presentation,
yes.
Go ahead.
The last item I have on this slide is we've streamlined and simplified our pharmacist application process. Our old process was extremely complex and confusing to new licensees, caused an awful lot of angst and problems. In the next several months, we should have this completed. It will be a much smoother, more logical process for them to follow and should provide a better service level for our licensees. We've streamlined our investigative case report developments and presentations. We completed our transition of human resources functions to DAS EHRS. We've also continued to cross-train job functions within the agency for more efficiency and redundancy in the event someone is out. And we've increased our online renewals, which allows us to reduce our staff work time. Our KPM slides. As you mentioned here, the second bullet under protecting Oregon consumers, I have an asterisk on that. When we transitioned from annual to biennial licensure, we lost the ability to capture that data. We audit for CE upon renewals. So when we went from 1 year to 2 years, we lost that ability. In 2015, the number was over 97%. But because we were not able to capture the data in 2016, it's zero. If you look historically, though, at our numbers, I think I can safely say that that number would be over 95%. And we do have an ask that the KPM be adjusted to reflect when we capture the data as opposed to just an annual basis. Does that answer?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like me to go through the rest of these individually?
Sure, briefly.
Okay. Pharmacies in compliance with our inspections, that number was 79% with a goal of 75%. And while this number looks a little bit low, it's there's a reason for this. As our inspectors go through a pharmacy inspection, if they find minor issues, they write a deficiency notice, and the pharmacy has 30 days in which to correct and address those issues. If they can show that they've corrected them and addressed them, it goes away. However, we do report the initial number on this report. So. That's a little lower than it looks, but it's an artificially low number. Pharmacies inspected, as I mentioned earlier, we inspected 100% of all the pharmacies in the state last year. Customer service, we had a goal of 100 days from opening a case to presenting the investigation. That number is 98 days. Our agency customer service is 92%. This is reflected every new licensee receives a questionnaire after the fact wanting to know how we did in seeking their input. I read every single one of these and we compile the information. 92% either excellent or good. In addition, we do several other just random requests. We send something out the last three renewal cycles to our pharmacists just asking how we're doing, what we can improve, what their experiences were. And again, I read every single one of those. It's allowed us insight into some things that we were not aware we could improve upon, and allowed us to address those.
Madam Chair,
yes,
quick question.
Representative.
Just a quick question.
Yes.
Do you set these goals annually or biannually? The percentage, the goals.
Those are annual.
Those are annual
yes.
goals.
I'm sorry, the KPMs themselves? Or the
so on this chart you have what the goal is?
Yes.
Those are set annually, you said?
I apologize. I believe those are set through the budgetary process.
Through the process, yeah. Biennial. So it's the key performance measures are set, the every 2 year budgeting process, they set that.
And as I said, I've been here 3 years. I've not been involved in any changes in that process, so I'm not aware exactly of what that is.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Major budget drivers for our agency are, I'm sure, what you see from everyone else. Personnel and related costs are the largest, represent over 66% of our total spend. Services and supplies has a large list of things underneath that. The top two in that for 2016 were our data processing and telecommunications, as well as our attorney general expense. And as I mentioned before, through our hearings process, we do everything we can to keep that number as low as possible. Okay, for our policy packages, policy package 100 is a licensing software upgrade for internal efficiencies and better customer service. Package cost of this is just under $352,000. I would like to point out that this is exactly the same package that we came to you with 2 years ago, and that we were unable to initiate or complete. There were a couple of reasons for that. The first, after the Cover Oregon issue, the CIO very appropriately initiated oversight and review processes for any computer upgrades. We were not prepared for that, so we had to re-engage, and there were a number of other agencies that had to as well. That slowed us down. The second issue there was our staff member who was in charge of this project became ill and was out on intermittent medical leave for over a year and a half. And in her absence, we were just not able to get this project up and running. That being said, we did not spend any of the funds that you allocated on this during that budget cycle. So this ask is simply an extension of the ask from 2 years ago. Our staffing levels and processes are such that I see no reason why we should not be able to complete this in 2 years in this budget cycle. Additionally, the cost for this package is totally being covered by a civil penalty that we received in 2014. In 2014, the board received a $540,000 settlement with a pharmaceutical manufacturer who was introduced adulterated drugs into the state. And it was apparent to us the last budget cycle that this was using this money, one-time money, to appropriately fund a software upgrade was a wise use of the money, and we could do so without impacting our licensees or having to raise any fees. Questions?
Okay. Go ahead.
The current software that we want to upgrade is 14 years old. It's reaching its end of life. Support for it is dwindling daily. The upgrade will transition us to a web-based database that also has cross-functionality with many of the other software that we use. So we expect to see a significant improvement both internally and to our licensees. It will allow us to do many things that we can't do at this point in time. And the project has been reviewed and approved by the CIO's office. Okay. Our second package. This is a mouthful. This is a grant to establish a shared academic and regulatory postgraduate fellowship program with the Pacific University College of Pharmacy. This is a rather unique project. It would be the first in the nation. There are currently three other postgraduate fellowship programs that pair academia and regulatory affairs in the country, but they're all based around manufacturing practices. This would be the first with a board of pharmacy. The fellow would be a faculty member at the Pacific University, and their time would be shared 50% with the board of pharmacy and 50% with Pacific University. Several positive aspects of this are right now, since I've been here, I've heard several times about the aging out potential for management in the state government. We have a significant number of senior management that are reaching retirement age, And some people feel that the pool of the talent pool to replace them isn't as deep as they would like. We're hopeful that this fellowship will inspire and educate people that want to seek careers in public administration or regulatory affairs in the state to seek these positions. While this is a pharmacist that is attending the fellowship, there's no reason that their background and the training that they have that they would not be able to transition this to other state agencies if they were so inclined to do so. The graduates from the program would be on track to pursue careers state public administration or regulatory affairs or in industry. And this package is supported by both of the state associations. Our last policy package, this is an increased board member per diem. At our last business meeting, our board voted to increase their per diem reimbursement rate from $30 to $100. This brings it more in line with what the other health care boards are doing. And the driver for this was that some of our board members are now not receiving no support from their employers for serving. And they felt that the increasing the per diem would allow them to offset some of the expenses that they incur for serving with us.
May I ask, is that more of are the pharmacy techs having more of a problem with that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
One is being supported partially, the other not at all.
Good to know. Thank you. Question. Senator Roblin?
Do they also receive mileage?
Yes.
Okay. Because getting people from the outside of the metropolitan area to come to those is getting harder. And without mileage and some kind of per diem to pay for a hotel, it's really difficult for them to want to even be on the board. So I appreciate this.
And we were very fortunate when this happened. We did outreach. We were able to acquire a pharmacy technician from the Dalles.
Yeah. That's exactly the kind of thing that I would hope would happen.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, final slide here, our government balance budget request this year is $7,530,291. This represents a 6.7% increase over the last budget. However, if we adjust for the continuation of the software package, it actually represents a 1.65% adjustment over the previous budget. And then, as I mentioned earlier, our projected cash balance through the biennial licensure, we anticipate that our ending balance will be driven down to $1,778,123, which is a $950,000 reduction over the previous budget. It reduces our cash reserves to approximately 5.5 months, which is an additional 3.85% reduction.
Senator Roblin?
So I understand going to biennial budgets. So did the biennial budget cut it in half, or was one group paying more than another? I mean, how close did that come? Because you've only, this budget shows both years. So, I mean, does it average out so that your cash flow is pretty good in both, by each section? I hope you understand what I mean.
Kind of.
Okay. Because, I mean, if depending on who, if you went text one time and other people another time, some pay more. So you're going to get an influx on one part of the biennium and less the next biennium. And does this overall show that balancing out so you won't lose another big chunk the next biennium? I don't want you to get in the place where all of a sudden you have to raise fees, and how did you have a big cash balance for so long and now you're down? So
yeah. Sort of a luck and planning happen here. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good.
That's true.
Our licenses expire for the pharmacists, and we move the technicians to June 30th every year.
Okay.
So the pharmacists do, their license is significantly higher. It's $125, I believe, and the technicians is $50. However, the expiration of that license is June 30th. So we are collecting at the very end of the biennium to carry it into it in both years. So through luck and planning, we don't have to worry about any budgetary issues.
Okay. That was what I was concerned about. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
And that is all.
Okay. Let me just start with a quick one. On KPMs, your key performance measures, so you don't have any new ones or changes beside the one that you noted?
We do not.
Okay. Okay.
If you would like us to investigate, we would be happy to do so.
Okay. Representative Wisnett?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask you and Senator Monroe, what's our guidance as far as the policy option packages? Because that came from the governor's budget, and the co-chair's budget didn't reference that. Are we going to still look at the policy option packages? Or
yes, and we can recommend changes, but if the governor's budget did not anticipate changes, we'll note that. Normally, unless they feel like there's a need for a change or the administration feels like there's a need for a change, we wouldn't make any changes.
Because it's follow-up, please. It's my understanding that the chair's co-chair's budget says it's based upon the existing revenue and not projected for any.
This is all. This board is also all other funds.
Yeah.
So that has a different impact
yeah,
too. That's
true.
And
yeah.
That's you'll notice that.
That's good.
That's what we're starting with.
Yeah, these licensing boards.
They have to pay for
all
these
of them are other funded,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so they really don't get into the mix
impact
of
that.
How much do we cut them?
Oh, great question.
Yeah, thank
great
you.
Great question. Representative Parrish?
Totally different question. How is the Board of Pharmacy intersecting with, like, the Office of Emergency Management on some of our issues around earthquakes and tsunami zones and customers who live in those areas and what would happen to them if we had a natural type disaster, and how do people get their prescriptions again when their prescription records are in the ocean?
Yeah, we I personally have not participated in these, but we are engaged in that process. We do have representation for all the discussions around that. There is a federal and a state plan for drug storage and introduction in that case. I don't know what the specifics are, but I do have two staff members that have been involved in this for the past 4 to 5 years in the planning, and we are an integral part of that.
If we could get some data on that. I Representative Lively and I also serve on a committee that talks about earthquakes a lot, so
okay.
I would be interested in having that information, because that's come up in our other hearings in Emergency Management Committee about, you know, what happens to people who suddenly, you know, have 20 prescriptions, they've been evacuated, how do we get them their meds quickly and ramp back up their healthcare access, you know, after an event?
Absolutely. I apologize, I've not been involved in those conversations,
okay.
But I can definitely provide that for you.
That would be helpful, thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Okay, if there are no further questions, Anthony Medina from DAS, I believe you are next.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. My name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. Before I begin, I would like to state that my presentation is designed to familiarize the committee of the agency and present the governor's recommended budget in a standard format. With that, I'll begin my presentation on the Board of Pharmacy. Prescription opioid abuse and opioid-related deaths are at an all-time high in Oregon and across the country. The governor's budget supports the agency's effort to curb opioid-related deaths. The governor's budget also maintains existing services and adds modest enhancements to 2017-19. As you can see, the governor's budget supports 2015-17 LAB with a few additional enhancements that I will get to shortly. And here's a quick graph of the expenditure category for the agency. As Mark went over, personnel services account for roughly 2/3 of the agency's expenses. For a period of time, the agency had steady revenue growth and built a sufficient ending balance. The agency then reduced fees, and the governor's budget supports those reduced fees through 17-19. The governor's budget maintains current services and invest in the my license business upgrade, the academic and regulatory fellowship, and board member per diem pops. The budget also has adjustments to the DAS price list and state government service charges. With that, concludes my presentation, and I can answer any questions the committee might have for me.
Thank you, Anthony. Could you go back one slide?
Yeah.
Can you just explain? Oh, sorry. To the last one, okay. To slide number 6. Yes. Could you expand or explain a little more what updates to the DAS price list and the state government service charges are?
Yeah. Yes, Co-Chair Smith-Warner.
Thank you.
So there's two. So for the DAS price list, the agencies for state government service charges, for state government service charge, saved roughly $43,000. And for Attorney General legal fees, there's a savings of roughly $23,000 for the agency.
Great.
And it's reflected in a drawdown of their expenditure limitation for service and supplies.
Great. Thank you.
That was fine.
Yes.
Anyone else? Senator Robin?
So on the DOJ, are they doing it? A contract with DOJ for services rendered, or because there's a small agency, is it a pay-as-they-go, and that's the history?
We have a contract at this point in time. I anticipate that will be renegotiated, and based upon our usage in the last year or so, it'll probably go up a little bit. We've controlled it as much as we could, but we are probably using a little more than what our current contract allows.
So this says that they anticipate it to go down. Right, and you're anticipating it that it'll go up. So, is there going to be a problem in the budget conversations?
The amount of increase I think we can absorb
okay.
through other means. It's not that significant, but we've had, as you can see, the number of cases that we have.
Right.
We're doing everything we can to keep it down, but I anticipate it will go up. But I certainly think we can absorb it within
the budget.
Current budget. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Thank you both. Oh, sorry. Representative Hernandez?
Maybe because I'm new and still trying to learn. So in the chart, let's see what page this is, or page 3 of your presentation. How much is the out of the governor's budget? Page 5, actually. Most of the revenue you receive is out of business license and fees.
Yes.
Is the that comes from general funds? Is it point one?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's the additional?
0.1 is though the other revenues.
Right.
I believe that's the ending balance.
Okay.
So it's from the revenue last versus
cycle.
Ending
so
balance.
There is no fiscal ask?
No. It's all other funds.
Okay.
It's all, they're all self-funded by licenses and fees. Yes.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Representative Hernandez. That other revenues is kind of a catch-all. Sometimes it includes various costs that the agency or various revenues that the agency incurs. They don't necessarily fall into one of these buckets. But in terms of their overall revenue, it accounts for a very small amount. But there is no general fund in the agency.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for these two? Okay. Thank you very much. I would like to acknowledge Kate James, the board president, who is here. And you are welcome to come up and say a few words, and you are welcome to not come up and say a few words as well. Completely at your discretion. Okay. Well, thank you for your service to the board. We very much appreciate it. Is there anyone else here that we are in a public hearing? Is there anyone else signed up? Okay. Anyone else who did not sign up, but who is moved to speak this morning? No? Okay. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5030. And while we have a little chunk of time left, I know that Doug Wilson, our overall analyst, is planning on continuing his kind of big picture briefing, but wasn't planning on doing it this morning. So we're going to recess a little bit early, and I will see you all here at 8:28 tomorrow morning. That.
8:28.
We are adjourned.
Good luck with that.
I apologize for being late.